Well, folks, as you will know if you are regularly here, we are using this year a marvellous resource, The Story. We began 5 weeks ago. This is week six. We started, of course, at the beginning. Where else would you begin a story? And we read in Genesis through the creation and then the fall and then the call of Abraham and his obedience to God. We went from Abraham to Jacob and to Joseph, and from the promised land, from Egypt, from Exodus to the promised land. And last week, how Moses led his people into the wilderness of Sinai, and there at the mountain of Sinai, how the people received from God the tablets of stone on which were inscribed the Ten Commandments. I mentioned to you then, and I will do so again now, that we have resources, additional resources that you may be interested in. Two books from our own David Serrell. Two books pertinent to those stories that we have so far covered in the story. This one here about Joseph. His arms were made strong is the subtitle. An excellent read on who Joseph was and his meaning for us. And then this one there. And then there were nine, it's called. And then there were nine. It's to do with the Ten Commandments. How we have lost sight of the importance of those Ten Commandments. Both are recommended for your further study, and both are available through in the hall after service today. And appropriately, Mary, David's brother, is going to be having those available to you. But now we go on to chapter 6 and the reading here now. Let's listen then together for the word of the Lord. The Lord said to Moses, "Send some men to explore the land of Canaan, which I am giving to the Israelites. From each ancestral tribe, send one of its leaders." When Moses sent them to explore Canaan, he said, "Go up through the Negev and on into the hill country. See what the land is like and whether the people who live there are strong or weak, few or many. What kind of land do they live in? Is it good or bad? What kind of towns do they live in? Are they unwalled or fortified? How is the soil? Is it fertile or poor? Are there trees in it or not? Do your best to bring back some of the fruit of the land." It was the season for the first ripe grapes. So they went up and explored the land from the desert of Zin as far as Rehob towards Lebo-Hamath. When they reached the valley of Eshcol, they cut off a branch bearing a single cluster of grapes. Two of them carried it on a pole between them, along with some pomegranates and figs. At the end of 40 days, they returned from exploring the land. They came back to Moses and Aaron and the whole Israelite community at Kadesh in the desert of Paran. There they reported to them, and the whole assembly showed them the fruit of the land. They gave Moses this account. "We went into the land to which you sent us, and it does flow with milk and honey. Here is its fruit. But the people who live there are powerful, and the cities are fortified and very large. We even saw descendants of Anak there." Then Caleb silenced the people before Moses and said, "We should go up and take possession of the land, for we can certainly do it." But the men who had gone up with him said, "We can't attack those people. They are stronger than we are." And they spread among the Israelites a bad report about the land they had explored. They said, "The land we explored devours those living in it. All the people we saw there are of great size. We saw the Nephilim there. The descendants of Anak come from the Nephilim. We seemed like grasshoppers in our eyes, and we looked the same to them." That night, All the members of the community raised their voices and wept aloud. All the Israelites grumbled against Moses and Aaron, and the whole assembly said to them, "If only we had died in Egypt or in this wilderness. Why is the Lord bringing us to this land only to let us fall by the sword? Our wives and children will be taken as plunder. Wouldn't it be better for us to go back to Egypt?" And they said to each other, "We should choose a leader and go back to Egypt." Then Moses and Aaron fell face down in front of the whole Israelite assembly gathered there. Joshua, son of Nun, and Caleb, son of Jephunneh, who were among those who had explored the land, tore their clothes and said to the entire Israelite assembly, "The land we passed through and explored is exceedingly good. If the Lord is pleased with us, he will lead us into the land, a land flowing with milk and honey, and will give it to us. Only, do not rebel against the Lord, and do not be afraid of the people of the land, because we will devour them." Their protection is gone, but the Lord is with us. Do not be afraid of them. Amen. And thanks be to God for this reading from his word. Well, this is chapter 6, as I was saying, of the story, and the chapter is entitled Wandering. Sometimes I'll say to Elaine, "I'm just going out for a wander." Usually I'll have the dog with me. Now, it's just a turn of phrase, but I think she knows that when I say it, I'll probably be back in half an hour or 40 minutes at the latest. That's what you mean when you say you're going out for a wander. Well, those Israelites were wandering for 40 years. 40 years from the Exodus from Egypt toward the Promised Land. Why so long? Why all those years? The answer, I think, is very clear. They were slow to learn. It is as if God was saying, "You can't enter the Promised Land until you have learned to trust me fully, and until you have learned to obey me fully. Then and only then can you enter the Promised Land." These were slow learners, these Israelites. Actually, I wonder if things are much changed. And during those 40 years, time and again, as they wandered from place to place, the frustration and discontent of the people bubbled up to the surface. Not surprising, really, I suppose. You've been told by your leader that he's taking you to the Promised Land, and years later, it seems as if you are no nearer, and all that you're aware of are your hardships and privations. It's taking too long in the eyes of the people. For 3 years, we as a family drove to France and to the west of France for our holiday, a car journey of nearly 1,000 miles. What were we thinking about? Three young boys in the back of the car. I well remember the first year. We got to Muirdrum. We got to Muirdrum before the famous question was asked, "Are we nearly there yet?" That was a heart-sinking moment, it really was. I guess there were many times when the Israelites said to Moses, "Are we nearly there yet?" I wonder if it was with that in mind that God spoke to Moses and had him send forward a kind of advance party to spy out the land, the promised land that was ahead of them. I wonder if the idea of this was that by bringing back some encouraging news of what lay in store, the people could be heartened just to keep going. Elaine and I walked the West Highland Way many, many years ago, well before we had boys to ask, are we nearly there yet? But she did a good job of that as well. I don't know who's all walked the West Highland Way, but the section, if you're heading north, which takes you along the coast of Loch Lomond, it seems to go on and on and on. Through trees and then over some moorland and back and up and down. You're looking at the map, you're sure it's just around the next corner, and yet it isn't. Well, she asked me plenty of times, are we nearly there yet? I have to confess I deceived her. I told her it was just around the next corner. Well, Moses sends this advance party ahead to bring back news that might well encourage the people. And so they set out, 12 of them in all, one from each of the 12 tribes of Israel. In other words, one from each of the families that had come from Jacob's 12 sons. And they travelled widely throughout Canaan, exploring, making notes on the land according to the questions that Moses had given them. Find out if the ground is fertile. Find out what sort of crops and fruits grow there. But beyond a kind of geographical and botanical assessment, he asked them to check out the land from a military perspective. And they did. And 40 days later, they returned and presented their report, their findings to Moses. And I guess it was the kind of report that began like this: Moses, we've got some good news, and we've got some bad news. I'm not sure if Moses then said, if they then asked Moses, which do you want first? But they went ahead and told him about the good news. The land is indeed flowing with milk and honey. In other words, as was said, as was promised, away back at the beginning, our forefather Abraham was promised this land, and indeed, it is like it was told to him, flowing with milk and honey. Of course, not literally, but just meaning a very fertile and productive and rich land. That was the good news. But they went on to say that in military terms, we've no chance. Quite simply, they're bigger than us, stronger than us. Their cities are fortified and well defended. But it turned out that within the group of 12, there was a serious difference of opinion. There was the majority report, which started off simply, we cannot. But there was too a minority report from two of them, which took exactly the opposite view. These two were, as Fat Cat introduced us to this morning, Caleb and Joshua. And they advocated advancing, the can-do approach. Do you know, when you are getting to know someone for the first time, maybe a group of people, before too long, you begin to make an assessment of the kind of person that they are. And part of that assessment might include this. Are they half glass full people? Or for them is the glass always half empty? I have a great friend, Robert, who is the most half glass empty person I've ever met. He's a great guy. But oh boy, if it's possible to see the negative in a thing, he will. If there are two possible outcomes, he will see the one that's to do with failure. Sometimes this is a personality trait, end of story. Sometimes, I think you could even go to so far as to say, in a general way, that it might be a national characteristic. A friend of mine spent 10 years ministering in the United States of America and then returned to minister in Aberdeen. I was with him about a year or so after he was back in Aberdeen, and I asked him, how would you describe essentially the difference between your folk in Aberdeen and your folk as they were in America? And he could have made a long list, I tell you. But the thing he said mainly was this. In Aberdeen, if, for example, at the Kirk session, somebody says, I've got an idea of something new that we might do, there will be a half a dozen voices raised almost immediately saying, here's why that won't work. Here's why we can't do it. But when I was in America and an idea was raised, immediately there were other voices there saying, here's how we could make that happen. I wonder if it's a sweeping generalization or if you can say that there are national characteristics. But this particular case of the 12 who saw things differently was nothing to do with either of these possible reasons. The difference between the 10 and the 2 was a matter of faith. Caleb and Joshua were not being unrealistic about the situation that was facing them, but they were believing and trusting that no matter what the situation, God would be with them in it, that he would go ahead of them. Folks, they looked at it through the eyes of faith. And this much is true. Things can look different when viewed through the eyes of faith. Impossibles can become possible when viewed through the eyes of faith. Despair can turn to hope when viewed through the eyes of faith. It can look different. Exactly the same scene can look different when viewed through the eyes of faith. The eyes of faith are able to say, regardless of the situation and circumstances, that in the end, all will be well. Will we sing?
Though we pass through tribulation, all will be well. Ours is such a full salvation, all will be well. Happy still in the confining, faithful living Christ above.
Is able to say, for example, in living or in dying, but faith remains hopeful, always believing that there is more than meets the eye. Perhaps the great definition of faith comes at the beginning of the 11th chapter of the book of Hebrews. A quiet confidence in what we hope for, and an assurance about that which we cannot see yet. And it was this faith that Joshua and Caleb possessed. The 10 others could only see what was right in front of their eyes, and it didn't look good. Joshua and Caleb saw the same scene, but could see through it and beyond it and above it, and trusted that God was with them in it, and so concluded differently. Joshua and Caleb were numbered among those ancients. My question is this: will future generations say it of us? Will we be numbered in time to come among those who possess faith? Faith to see forward. Will they say of us, as they did of Caleb, that we had something of a different spirit, and that we followed faithfully and wholeheartedly as Caleb did? I wonder, what will they say of us? Folks, if you are familiar with any Jewish people, if you're familiar with Jewish tradition, you will know that even today, faithful Jews begin every day and end every day and teach their children the prayer that is known as the Shema. It is two parts, I suppose. First of all, it's a declaration of faith in their monotheistic faith, which is to say, their faith that there is only one God. And beyond the declaration of faith, there is a commitment of faith that we will love God and obey Him. Incidentally, I think this part is mistaken time and time again. Folks think of loving God and obeying God as somehow different. Let me tell you, they are inextricably linked. You cannot say you love God if at the same time you're not obeying God, if you're not living life according to His ways. And this is the prayer that faithful Jews recite together every day. We know that Jesus Himself quoted it, but it was first heard during these years of wilderness wandering. in the days that preceded their entry into the promised land. These were defining moments as Moses addressed the people. For them, but so for us, it seems to me that there come moments in life which are entirely defining moments. Moments in life when we have to decide, who ultimately am I? What am I going to be? How will I be known? Whose side am I on? And there was such a moment in the wilderness just before the people entered the promised land. Such a defining moment when Moses set before them the ultimate choice. And it is still that way. God still offers us a choice. And for every single human being, it is the defining moment in your life. As it was for the nation of Israel, as they stood on the edge of their future, or the decision to turn back to Egypt and to slavery. That moment when it was theirs to choose. It's a huge choice. But it's made up of lots of small, everyday moments. Choosing to do the right thing every day, each day. And the question that hangs through all of eternity is this one: what will your choice be? Today, the Lord of heaven and earth is calling out, saying that I set before you a choice, life, blessings, or death. What will your choice be? And might it in the end be said of you that the Lord is your life? For Moses, this marked the end of the road. He got to the border country, he got to see the promised land, but never himself was able to set foot in it. But always in God's planning, there is succession. And in his final days, he commissioned Joshua, one of the two spies, one of the two faithful, to be the new leader. And next week, in chapter 7 of the story, we will read of Joshua. Amen. Thanks be to God for his word.